After the house, we were to see the grounds and the swimming pool and the hydroplane and the midsummer flowers. But outside Gatsby's window, it began to rain again, so we stood in a row looking at the corrugated surface of the sound. "If it wasn't for the mist, we could see your home across the bay," said Gatsby. "You always have a green light that burns all night at the end of your dock." Daisy put her arm through his abruptly, but he seemed absorbed in what he had just said. Possibly it had occurred to him that the colossal significance of that light had now vanished forever. Compared to the great distance that had separated him from Daisy, it had seemed very near to her, almost touching her. It had seemed as close as a star to the moon. Now it was again a green light on a dock. His count of enchanted objects had diminished by one. I began to walk about the room, examining various indefinite objects in the half-darkness. A large photograph of an elderly man in yachting costume attracted me, hung on the wall over his desk. "Who's this?"
That's Mr. Dan Cody, old sport."
The name sounded faintly familiar.
"He's dead now. He used to be my best friend years ago."
There was a small picture of Gatsby, also in yachting costume, on the bureau. Gatsby with his head thrown back defiantly, taken apparently when he was about 18.
"I adore it," exclaimed Daisy. "The pompadour. You never told me you had a pompadour. Or a yacht."
"Look at this," said Gatsby quickly. "Here's a lot of clippings. About you." They stood side by side examining it. I was going to ask to see the rubies when the phone rang, and Gatsby took up the receiver.
"Yes?"
"Well, I can't talk now. I can't talk now, old sport."
"I said a small town. He must know what a small town is."
"Well, he's no use to us if Detroit is his idea of a small town." He rang off.
"Come here quick,"
cried Daisy at the window. The rain was still falling, but the darkness had parted in the west, and there was a pink and golden billow of foamy clouds above the sea.
"Look at that," she whispered.
And then after a moment, "I'd like to just get one of those pink clouds and put you in it and push you around." I tried to go then, but they wouldn't hear of it. Perhaps my presence made them feel more satisfactorily alone.
"I know what we'll do," said Gatsby. "We'll have Clip Springer play the piano."
He went out of the room calling, "Ewing!" and returned in a few minutes accompanied by an embarrassed, slightly worn young man with shell-rimmed glasses and scanty blonde hair. He was now decently dressed in a sports shirt, open at the neck, sneakers, and duck trousers of a nebulous blue.
"Did we interrupt your exercises?" inquired Daisy politely.
"I was asleep," cried Mr. Clipspringer in a spasm of embarrassment. "That is, I'd been asleep. Then I got up."
"Clipspringer plays the piano," said Gatsby, cutting him off. "Don't you, Ewing, old sport?"
"I don't play well. I hardly play at all. I'm all out of practice."
"Well, go downstairs," interrupted Gatsby.
He flipped a switch. The gray windows disappeared as the house glowed full of light. In the music room, Gatsby turned on a solitary lamp beside the piano. He lit Daisy's cigarette from a trembling match and sat down with her on a couch far across the room where there was no light save what the gleaming floor bounced in from the hall. When Clipspringer had played the Love Nest, he turned around on the bench and searched unhappily for Gatsby in the gloom.
"I'm all out of practice, you see. I told you I couldn't play. I'm all out of practice."
"Don't talk so much, old sport," commanded Gatsby. "Play."
"In the morning, in the evening, ain't we got fun?" Outside, the wind was loud, and there was a faint flow of thunder along the sound. All the lights were going on in West Egg now. The electric trains, men carrying, were plunging home through the rain from New York. It was the hour of a profound human change, and excitement was generating on the air. One thing sure and nothing surer, the rich get richer and the poor get children. In the meantime, in between time. As I went over to say goodbye, I saw that the expression of bewilderment had come back into Gatsby's face, as though a faint doubt had occurred to him as to the quality of his present happiness. Almost 5 years. There must have been moments even that afternoon when Daisy tumbled short of his dreams. Not through her own fault, but because of the colossal vitality of his illusion. It had gone beyond her, beyond everything. He had thrown himself into it with a creative passion, adding to it all the time,
decking it out with every bright feather that drifted his way. No amount of fire or freshness can challenge what a man will store up in his ghostly heart. As I watched him, he adjusted himself a little, visibly. His hand took hold of hers, and as she said something low in his ear, he turned toward her with a rush of emotion. I think that voice held him most, with its fluctuating, feverish warmth, because it couldn't be overdreamed. That voice was a deathless song. They had forgotten me, but Daisy glanced up and held out her hand. Gatsby didn't know me now at all. I looked once more at them, and they looked back at me remotely, possessed by intense life. Then I went out of the room and down the marble steps into the rain, leaving them there together. Chapter 6. About this time, an ambitious young reporter from New York arrived one morning at Gatsby's door and asked him if he had anything to say. "Anything to say about what?" inquired Gatsby politely. "Why, any statement to give out." It transpired after a confused 5 minutes that the man had heard Gatsby's name around his office in a connection which he either wouldn't reveal or didn't fully understand. This was his day off, and with laudable initiative he had hurried out to see. It was a random shot, and yet the reporter's instinct was right. Gatsby's notoriety, spread about by the hundreds who had accepted his hospitality and so become authorities upon his past, had increased all summer until he fell just short of being news. Contemporary legends, such as the underground pipeline to Canada, attached themselves to him, and there was one persistent story that he didn't live in a house at all, but in a boat that looked like a house and was moved secretly up and down the Long Island shore. Just why these inventions were a source of satisfaction to James Gatz of North Dakota isn't easy to say. James Gatz. That was really, or at least legally, his name. He had changed it at the age of 17, and at the specific moment that witnessed the beginning of his career, when he saw Dan Cody's yacht drop anchor over the most insidious flat on Lake Superior. It was James Gatz who had been loafing along the beach that afternoon in a torn green jersey and a pair of canvas pants, but it was already Jay Gatsby who borrowed a rowboat, pulled out to the Tuolumne, and informed Cody that a wind might catch him and break him up in half an hour. I suppose he'd had the name ready for a long time even then. His parents were shiftless and unsuccessful farm people. His imagination had never really accepted them as his parents at all. The truth was that Jay Gatsby of West Egg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself. He was a son of God, a phrase which, if it means anything, means just that, and he must be about his father's business, the service of a vast, vulgar, and meretricious beauty. So he invented just the sort of Jay Gatsby that a 17-year-old boy would be likely to invent, and to this conception he was faithful to the end. For over a year, he had been beating his way along the south shore of Lake Superior as a clam digger and a salmon fisher, or in any other capacity that brought him food and bed. His brown, hardening body lived naturally through the half-fierce, half-lazy work of the bracing days. He knew women early, and since they spoiled him, he became contemptuous of them. Of young virgins because they were ignorant, of the others because they were hysterical about things which in his overwhelming self-absorption he took for granted. But his heart was in a constant turbulent riot. The most grotesque and fantastic conceits haunted him in his bed at night. A universe of ineffable gaudiness spun itself out in his brain, while the clock ticked on the washstand and the moon soaked with wet light his tangled clothes upon the floor. Each night he added to the pattern of his fancies until drowsiness closed down upon some vivid scene with an oblivious embrace. For a while, these reveries provided an outlet for his imagination. They were a satisfactory hint of the unreality of reality, a promise that the rock of the world was founded securely on a fairy's wing. An instinct toward his future glory had led him some months before to the small Lutheran College of St. Olaf's in southern Minnesota. He stayed there 2 weeks, dismayed at its ferocious indifference to the drums of his destiny, to destiny itself, and despising the janitor's work with which he was to pay his way through. Then he drifted back to Lake Superior, and he was still searching for something to do on the day that Dan Cody's yacht dropped anchor in the shallows alongshore. Cody was 50 years old then, a product of the Nevada silver fields, of the Yukon, of every rush for metal since 75. The transactions in Montana copper that made him many times a millionaire found him physically robust, but on the verge of soft-mindedness. And suspecting this, an infinite number of women tried to separate him from his money. The none too savory ramifications by which Ella Kay, the newspaper woman, played Madame de Maintenon to his weakness and sent him to sea in a yacht were common knowledge to the turgid sub or suppressed journalism of 1902. He'd been coasting along all too hospitable shores for 5 years when he turned up as James Gatz's destiny in Little Girl Bay. To young Gatz, resting on his oars and looking up at the railed deck, that yacht represented all the beauty and glamour in the world. I suppose he smiled at Cody. He'd probably discovered that people liked him when he smiled. At any rate, Cody asked him a few questions, one of them elicited the brand new name, and found that he was quick and extravagantly ambitious. A few days later, he took him to Duluth and bought him a blue coat, 6 pairs of white duck trousers, and a yachting cap. And when the Tuolumne left for the West Indies and the Barbary Coast, Gatsby left, too. He was employed in a vague personal capacity. While he remained with Cody, he was in turn steward, mate, skipper, secretary, and even jailer. For Dan Cody sober knew what lavish doings Dan Cody drunk might soon be about, and he provided for such contingencies by reposing more and more trust in Gatsby. The arrangement lasted 5 years, during which the boat went 3 times around the continent. It might have lasted indefinitely, except for the fact that Ella Kay came on board one night in Boston, and a week later Dan Cody inhospitably died. I remember the portrait of him up in Gatsby's bedroom, a grave, florid man with a hard, empty face, the pioneer debauchee, who during one phase of American life brought back to the eastern seaboard the savage violence of the frontier brothel and saloon. It was indirectly due to Cody that Gatsby drank so little. Sometimes in the course of gay parties, women used to rub champagne into his hair. For himself, he formed the habit of letting liquor alone. And it was from Cody that he inherited money, a legacy of $25,000. He didn't get it. He never understood the legal device that was used against him, but what remained of the millions went intact to Ella Kay. He was left with his singularly appropriate education. The vague contour of Jay Gatsby had filled out to the substantiality of a man. He told me all this very much later, but I've put it down here with the idea of exploding those first wild rumors about his antecedents which weren't even faintly true. Moreover, he told it to me at a time of confusion, when I'd reached the point of believing everything and nothing about him. So I take advantage of this short halt, while Gatsby, so to speak, caught his breath, to clear this set of misconceptions away. It was a halt, too, in my association with his affairs. For several weeks, I didn't see him or hear his voice on the phone. Mostly I was in New York, trotting around with Jordan, and trying to ingratiate myself with her senile aunt. But finally, I went over to his house one Sunday afternoon. I hadn't been there 2 minutes when somebody brought Tom Buchanan in for a drink. I was startled, naturally, but the really surprising thing was that it hadn't happened before. They were a party of 3 on horseback, Tom and a man named Sloan, and a pretty woman in a brown riding habit who had been there previously. "I'm delighted to see you," said Gatsby, standing on his porch. "I'm delighted that you dropped in." As though they cared. "Sit right down. Have a cigarette or a cigar." He walked around the room quickly, ringing bells. "I'll have something to drink for you in just a minute." He was profoundly affected by the fact that Tom was there. But he would be uneasy anyhow until he had given them something, realizing in a vague way that that was all they came for. Mr. Sloan wanted nothing. A lemonade? No, thanks. A little champagne? Nothing at all, thanks. "I'm sorry. Do you have a nice ride?
Very good roads around here.
I suppose the automobiles...
Yeah.
Moved by an irresistible impulse, Gatsby turned to Tom, who had accepted the introduction as a stranger. I believe we've met somewhere before, Mr. Buchanan.
Oh, yes, said Tom, gruffly polite, but obviously not remembering.
So we did. I remember very well.
About 2 weeks ago.
That's right. You were with Nick here.
I know your wife, continued Gatsby, almost aggressively.
That's so.
Tom turned to me.
You live near here, Nick?
Next door.
That's so.
Mr. Sloan didn't enter into the conversation, but lounged back haughtily in his chair. The woman said nothing either, until unexpectedly, after two highballs, she became cordial.
We'll all come over to your next party, Mr. Gatsby, she suggested. What do you say?
Certainly, I'd be delighted to have you.
Be very nice, said Mr. Sloan, without gratitude.
Well, I think I ought to be starting home.
Oh, please don't hurry, Gatsby urged them. He had control of himself now, and he wanted to see more of Tom.
Why don't you stay for supper?
I wouldn't be surprised if some other people dropped in from New York.
You'd come to supper with me, said the lady enthusiastically. Both of you.
This included me. Mr. Sloan got to his feet. Come along, he said, but only to her.
I mean it, she insisted. I'd love to have you. Lots of room.
Gatsby looked at me questioningly. He wanted to go, and he didn't see that Mr. Sloan had determined he shouldn't.
I'm afraid I won't be able to, I said.
Well, you come, she urged, concentrating on Gatsby.
Mr. Sloan murmured something close to her ear.
We won't be late if we start now, she insisted aloud.
I haven't got a horse, said Gatsby. I used to ride in the army, but I've never bought a horse. I'll have to follow you in my car. Excuse me for just a minute.
The rest of us walked out on the porch, where Sloan and the lady began an impassioned conversation aside.
My God, I believe the man's coming, said Tom.
Doesn't he know she doesn't want him?
Well, she says she does want him.
She has a big dinner party, and he won't know a soul there. He frowned.
I wonder where in the devil he met Daisy.
By God, I may be old-fashioned in my ideas, but women run around too much these days to suit me. They meet all kinds of crazy fish.
Suddenly, Mr. Sloan and the lady walked down the steps and mounted their horses.
Come on, said Mr. Sloan to Tom. We're late. We've got to go.
And then to me, tell him we couldn't wait, will you?
Tom and I shook hands, the rest of us exchanged a cool nod, and they trotted quickly down the drive, disappearing under the August foliage just as Gatsby, with hat and light overcoat in hand, came out the front door.
Tom was evidently perturbed at Daisy's running around alone, for on the following Saturday night he came with her to Gatsby's party. Perhaps his presence gave the evening its peculiar quality of oppressiveness. It stands out in my memory from Gatsby's other parties that summer. There were the same people, or at least the same sort of people, the same profusion of champagne, the same many-colored, many-keyed commotion, but I felt an unpleasantness in the air, a pervading harshness that hadn't been there before. Or perhaps I'd merely grown used to it, grown to accept West Egg as a world complete in itself with its own standards and its own great figures, second to nothing because it had no consciousness of being so. And now I was looking at it again through Daisy's eyes. It is invariably saddening to look through new eyes at things upon which you've expended your own powers of adjustment. They arrived at twilight, and as we strolled out among the sparkling hundreds, Daisy's voice was playing murmurous tricks in her throat.
These things excite me so, she whispered. If you want to kiss me any time during the evening, Nick, just let me know, and I'll be glad to arrange it for you. Just mention my name, or present a green card. I'm giving out green...
Look around, suggested Gatsby.
I'm looking around. I'm having a marvelous... You must see the faces of many people you've heard about.
Tom's arrogant eyes roamed the crowd.
We don't go around very much, he said. In fact, I was just thinking I don't know a soul here.
Well, perhaps you know that lady. Gatsby indicated a gorgeous, scarcely human orchid of a woman who sat in state under a white plum tree.
Tom and Daisy stared with that particularly unreal feeling that accompanies the recognition of a hitherto ghostly celebrity of the movies.
She's lovely, said Daisy.
The man bending over her is her director. He took them ceremoniously from group to group. Mrs. Buchanan and Mr. Buchanan. After an instant's hesitation, he added, the polo player.
Oh, no, objected Tom quickly, not me.
But evidently the sound of it pleased Gatsby, for Tom remained the polo player for the rest of the evening.
I've never met so many celebrities, Daisy exclaimed. I like that man, what was his name, with the sort of blue nose?
Gatsby identified him, adding that he was a small producer.
Well, I liked him anyhow.
I'd a little rather not be the polo player, said Tom pleasantly. I'd rather look at all these famous people in oblivion.
Daisy and Gatsby danced. I remember being surprised by his graceful, conservative foxtrot. I'd never seen him dance before.
Then they sauntered over to my house and sat on the steps for half an hour, while at her request I remained watchfully in the garden.
In case there's a fire or a flood, she explained, or any act of God.
Tom appeared from his oblivion as we were sitting down to supper together.
You mind if I eat with some people over here, he said. A fellow's getting off some funny stuff.
Go ahead, answered Daisy genially, and if you want to take down any addresses, here's my little gold pencil.
She looked around after a moment and told me the girl was common but pretty. And I knew that except for the half hour she'd been alone with Gatsby, she wasn't having a good time. We were at a particularly tipsy table. That was my fault. Gatsby had been called to the phone, and I'd enjoyed these same people only 2 weeks before. But what had amused me then turned septic on the air now.
How do you feel, Miss Baedeker?
The girl addressed was trying unsuccessfully to slump against my shoulder. At this inquiry, she sat up and opened her eyes.
What?
A massive and lethargic woman who had been urging Daisy to play golf with her at the local club tomorrow spoke in Miss Baedeker's defense.
Oh, she's all right now. When she's had five or six cocktails, she always starts screaming like that. I tell her she ought to leave it alone.
I do leave it alone, affirmed the accused hollowly.
We heard you yelling, so I said to Doc Civet here, there's somebody that needs your help, Doc.
She's much obliged, I'm sure, said another friend without gratitude, but you got her dress all wet when you stuck her head in the pool.
Anything I hate is to get my head stuck in the pool, mumbled Miss Baedeker. They almost drowned me once over in New Jersey.
Then you ought to leave it alone, countered Dr. Civet.
Speak for yourself, cried Miss Baedeker violently. Your handshakes. I wouldn't let you operate on me.
It was like that. Almost the last thing I remember was standing with Daisy and watching the moving picture director and his star. They were still under the white plum tree, and their faces were touching except for a pale, thin ray of moonlight between. It occurred to me that he had been very slowly bending toward her all evening to attain this proximity, and even while I watched, I saw him stoop one ultimate degree and kiss at her cheek.
I like her, said Daisy. I think she's lovely.
But the rest offended her. And inarguably, because it wasn't a gesture but an emotion. She was appalled by West Egg, this unprecedented place that Broadway had begotten upon a Long Island fishing village, appalled by its raw vigor that chafed under the old euphemisms, and by the too obtrusive fate that herded its inhabitants along a shortcut from nothing to nothing. She saw something awful in the very simplicity she failed to understand. I sat on the front steps with them while they waited for their car. It was dark here in front. Only the bright door sent 10 square feet of light volleying out into the soft black morning. Sometimes a shadow moved against the dressing room blind above, gave way to another shadow, an indefinite procession of shadows that rouged and powdered in an invisible glass.
"Who is this Gatsby, anyhow?" demanded Tom suddenly. "Some big bootlegger?"
"Where'd you hear that?" I inquired.
"I didn't hear it. I imagined it. A lot of these newly rich people are just big bootleggers, you know."
"Not Gatsby," I said shortly.
He was silent for a moment. The pebbles of the drive crunched under his feet.
"Well, he certainly must have strained himself to get this menagerie together."
A breeze stirred the gray haze of Daisy's fur collar.
"At least they're more interesting than the people we know," she said with an effort.
"You didn't look so interested."
"Well, I was."
Tom laughed and turned to me. "Did you notice Daisy's face when that girl asked her to put her under a cold shower?" Daisy began to sing with the music in a husky, rhythmic whisper, bringing out a meaning in each word that it had never had before and would never have again. When the melody rose, her voice broke up sweetly, following it in a way contralto voices have, and each change tipped out a little of her warm, human magic upon the air.
"Lots of people come who haven't been invited," she said suddenly. "That girl hadn't been invited. They simply force their way in, and he's too polite to object."
"I'd like to know who he is and what he does," insisted Tom. "I think I'll make a point of finding out."
"I can tell you right now," she answered. "He owns some drug stores, a lot of drug stores. He built them up himself."
The dilatory limousine came rolling up the drive.
"Good night, Nick," said Daisy.
Her glance left me and sought the lighted top of the steps, where at 3 o'clock in the morning a neat, sad little waltz of that year was drifting out the open door. After all, in the very casualness of Gatsby's party, there were romantic possibilities totally absent from her world. What was it up there in the song that seemed to be calling her back inside? What would happen now, in the dim, incalculable hours? Perhaps some unbelievable guest would arrive, a person infinitely rare and to be marveled at, some authentically radiant young girl who, with one fresh glance at Gatsby, one moment of magical encounter, would blot out those 5 years of unwavering devotion. I stayed late that night. Gatsby asked me to wait until he was free, and I lingered in the garden until the inevitable swimming party had run up chilled and exalted from the black beach, until the lights were extinguished in the guest rooms overhead. When he came down the steps at last, the tanned skin was drawn unusually tight on his face, and his eyes were bright and tired.
"She didn't like it," he said immediately.
"Of course she did. She didn't like it," he insisted. "She didn't have a good time." He was silent, and I guessed at his unutterable depression. "I feel far away from her," he said. "It's hard to make her understand."
"You mean about the dance?"
"The dance?" He dismissed all the dances he'd given with a snap of his fingers. "Old sport, the dance is unimportant." He wanted nothing less of Daisy than that she should go to Tom and say, "I never loved you." After she had obliterated 4 years with that sentence, they could decide upon the more practical measures to be taken. One of them was that after she was free, they were to go back to Louisville and be married from her house, just as if it were 5 years ago.
"And she doesn't understand," he said.
"She used to be able to understand. We'd sit for hours." He broke off and began to walk up and down a desolate path of fruit rinds and discarded favors and crushed flowers.
"I wouldn't ask too much of her," I ventured. "You can't repeat the past."
"Can't repeat the past?" he cried incredulously.
"Why, of course you can."
He looked around him wildly, as if the past were lurking here in the shadow of his house, just out of reach of his hand.
"I'm going to fix everything just the way it was before," he said, nodding determinedly.
"She'll see." He talked a lot about the past, and I gathered that he wanted to recover something, some idea of himself, perhaps, that had gone into loving Daisy. His life had been confused and disordered since then, but if he could once return to a certain starting place and go over it all slowly, he could find out what that thing was. One autumn night, 5 years before, they had been walking down the street when the leaves were falling, and they came to a place where there were no trees and the sidewalk was white with moonlight. They stopped here and turned toward each other. Now it was a cool night, with that mysterious excitement in it which comes at the two changes of the year. The quiet lights in the houses were humming out into the darkness, and there was a stir and bustle among the stars. Out of the corner of his eye, Gatsby saw that the blocks of the sidewalks really formed a ladder and mounted to a secret place above the trees. He could climb to it if he climbed alone, and once there, he could suck on the pap of life, gulped down the incomparable milk of wonder. His heart beat faster and faster as Daisy's white face came up to his own. He knew that when he kissed this girl and forever wed his unutterable visions to her perishable breath, His mind would never romp again like the mind of God. So he waited, listening for a moment longer to the tuning fork that had been struck upon a star. Then he kissed her. At his lips' touch, she blossomed for him like a flower, and the incarnation was complete. Through all he said, even through his appalling sentimentality, I was reminded of something, an elusive rhythm, a fragment of lost words that I had heard somewhere a long time ago. For a moment, a phrase tried to take shape in my mouth, and my lips parted like a dumb man's, as though there was more struggling upon them than a wisp of startled air. But they made no sound, and what I had almost remembered was uncommunicable forever. Chapter 7. It was when curiosity about Gatsby was at its highest that the lights in his house failed to go on one Saturday night. And as obscurely as it had begun, his career as Trimalchio was over. Only gradually did I become aware that the automobiles which turned expectantly into his drive stayed for just a minute and then drove sulkily away. Wondering if he was sick, I went over to find out. An unfamiliar butler with a villainous face squinted at me suspiciously from the door. "Is Mr. Gatsby sick?" "Nope." After a pause, he added, "Sir," in a dilatory, grudging way. I hadn't seen him around, and I was rather worried. "Tell him Mr. Carraway came over." "Who?" he demanded rudely. "Carraway." "Carraway, all right, I'll tell him." Abruptly, he slammed the door. My Finn informed me that Gatsby had dismissed every servant in his house a week ago and replaced them with half a dozen others who never went into West Egg Village to be bribed by the tradesmen, but ordered moderate supplies over the telephone. The grocery boy reported that the kitchen looked like a pigsty, and the general opinion in the village was that the new people weren't servants at all. Next day, Gatsby called me on the phone. "Going away?" I inquired. "No, old sport." "I hear you fired all your servants." "I wanted somebody who wouldn't gossip. Daisy comes over quite often, in the afternoons." So the whole caravansary had fallen in like a card house at the disapproval in her eyes. "There are some people Wolfsheim wanted to do something for. They're all brothers and sisters. They used to run a small hotel."
"I see."
He was calling up at Daisy's request. Would I come to lunch at her house tomorrow? Miss Baker would be there. Half an hour later, Daisy herself telephoned and seemed relieved to find that I was coming. Something was up, and yet I couldn't believe that they would choose this occasion for a scene, especially for the rather harrowing scene that Gatsby had outlined in the garden. The next day was broiling, almost the last, certainly the warmest of the summer. As my train emerged from the tunnel into sunlight, only the hot whistles of the National Biscuit Company broke the simmering hush at noon. The straw seats of the car hovered on the edge of combustion. The woman next to me perspired delicately for a while into her white shirt waist, and then, as her newspaper dampened under her fingers, lapsed despairingly into deep heat with a desolate cry. Her pocketbook slapped to the floor. "Oh, my," she gasped. I picked it up with a weary bend and handed it back to her, holding it at arm's length and by the extreme tip of the corners to indicate that I had no designs upon it. But everyone nearby, including the woman, suspected me just the same.
"Hot," said the conductor to familiar faces. "Some weather. Hot. 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 Hot enough for you? Is it hot? Is it?"
My commutation ticket came back to me with a dark stain from his hand. That anyone should care in this heat, whose flushed lips he kissed, whose head made damp the pajama pocket over his heart. Through the hall of the Buchanan's house blew a faint wind, carrying the sound of the telephone bell out to Gatsby and me as we waited at the door.
"The master's body!" roared the butler into the mouthpiece. "I'm sorry, madam, but we can't furnish it. It's far too hot to touch this noon."
What he really said was, "Yes, yes, I'll see." He set down the receiver and came toward us, glistening slightly, to take our stiff straw hats. "Madam expects you in the salon," he cried, needlessly indicating the direction. In this heat, every extra gesture was an affront to the common store of life. The room, shadowed well with awnings, was dark and cool. Daisy and Jordan lay upon an enormous couch like silver idols weighing down their own white dresses against the singing breeze of the fans. "We can't move," they said together. Jordan's fingers, powdered white over their tan, rested for a moment in mine. "And Mr. Thomas Buchanan, the athlete?" I inquired. Simultaneously, I heard his voice, gruff, muffled, husky at the hall telephone. Gatsby stood in the center of the crimson carpet and gazed around with fascinated eyes. Daisy watched him and laughed her sweet, exciting laugh. A tiny gust of powder rose from her bosom into the air. "The rumor is," whispered Jordan, "that that's Tom's girl on the telephone." We were silent. The voice in the hall rose high with annoyance. "Very well, then, I won't sell you the car at all. I'm under no obligations to you at all. And as for your bothering me about it at lunchtime, I won't stand that at all." "Holding down the receiver," said Daisy cynically. "No, he's not," I assured her. "It's a bona fide deal. I happen to know about it." Tom flung open the door, blocked out its space for a moment with his thick body, and hurried into the room. "Mr. Gatsby," he put out his broad, flat hand with well-concealed dislike. "I'm glad to see you, sir. Nick?" "Make us a cold drink," cried Daisy. As he left the room again, she got up and went over to Gatsby and pulled his face down, kissing him on the mouth. "You know I love you," she murmured.
"You forget there's a lady present," said Jordan.
Daisy looked around doubtfully. "You kiss Nick, too." "What a low, vulgar girl." "I don't care," cried Daisy, and began to clog on the brick fireplace. Then she remembered the heat and sank down guiltily on the couch, just as a freshly laundered nurse leading a little girl came into the room. "Blessed precious," she crooned, holding out her arms. "Come to your own mother that loves you." The child, relinquished by the nurse, rushed across the room and rooted shyly into her mother's dress. "The blessed precious. Did mother get powder on your old yellowy hair? Now, stand up now and say howdy do." Gatsby and I, in turn, leaned down and took the small, reluctant hand. Afterward, he kept looking at the child with surprise. I don't think he had ever really believed in its existence before. "I got dressed before luncheon," said the child, turning eagerly to Daisy. "That's because your mother wanted to show you off." Her face bent into the single wrinkle of the small white neck. "You dream, you absolute little dream." "Yes," admitted the child calmly. "Aunt Jordan's got on a white dress, too. How do you like mother's friends?" Daisy turned her around so that she faced Gatsby. "Do you think they're pretty? Where's Daddy?" "She doesn't look like her father," explained Daisy. "She looks like me. She's got my hair and shape of the face." Daisy sat back upon the couch. The nurse took a step forward and held out her hand. "Come, Pammy." "Goodbye, sweetheart." With a reluctant backward glance, the well-disciplined child held to her nurse's hand and was pulled out the door, just as Tom came back preceding four gin rickeys that clicked full of ice. Gatsby took up his drink. "They certainly look cool," he said with visible tension. We drank in long, greedy swallows. "I read somewhere that the sun's getting hotter every year," said Tom genially. "It seems that pretty soon the earth's going to fall into the sun. Well, wait a minute. It's just the opposite. The sun's getting colder every year." "Come outside," he suggested to Gatsby. "I'd like to have you look at the place." I went with him out to the veranda. On the green sound, stagnant in the heat, one small sail crawled slowly toward the fresher sea. Gatsby's eyes followed it momentarily. He raised his hand and pointed across the bay. "I'm right across from you." "Yeah, so you are." Our eyes lifted over the rose beds and the hot lawn and the weedy refuse of the dog days alongshore. Slowly, the white wings of the boat moved against the blue, cool limit of the sky. Ahead lay the scalloped ocean and the abounding Blessed Isles. "There's sport for you," said Tom, nodding. "I'd like to be out there with them for about an hour." We had luncheon in the dining room, darkened too against the heat, and drank down nervous gaiety with the cold ale. "What'll we do with ourselves this afternoon?" cried Daisy. "And the day after that, in the next 30 years. Don't be morbid, Jordan said. Life starts all over again when it gets crisp in the fall.
But it's so hot, insisted Daisy on the verge of tears. And everything's so confused. Let's all go to town.
Her voice struggled on through the heat, beating against it, molding its senselessness into forms.
I've heard of making a garage out of a stable, Tom was saying to Gatsby, but I'm the first man who ever made a stable out of a garage.
Who wants to go to town? Demanded Daisy insistently. Gatsby's eyes floated toward her.
Ah, she cried, you look so cool.
Their eyes met, and they stared together at each other, alone in space. With an effort, she glanced down at the table.
You always look so cool, she repeated.
She had told him that she loved him, and Tom Buchanan saw. He was astounded. His mouth opened a little, and he looked at Gatsby, and then back at Daisy, as if he had just recognized her as someone he knew a long time ago.
You resemble the advertisement of the man, she went on innocently. You know, the advertisement of the man...
All right, broke in Tom quickly. I'm perfectly willing to go to town. Come on, we're all going to town.
He got up, his eyes still flashing between Gatsby and his wife. No one moved.
Come on! His temper cracked a little. What's the matter, anyhow? If we're going to town, let's start.
His hand, trembling with his effort at self-control, bore to his lips the last of his glass of ale. Daisy's voice got us to our feet and out onto the blazing gravel drive.
Why, are we just going to go? She objected. Like this? Or aren't we going to let anyone smoke a cigarette first?
Everybody smoked all through lunch.
Oh, let's have fun, she begged him. It's too hot to fuss.
He didn't answer.
Have it your own way, she said. Come on, Jordan.
They went upstairs to get ready, while we three men stood there shuffling the hot pebbles with our feet. A silver curve of the moon hovered already in the western sky. Gatsby started to speak, changed his mind, but not before Tom wheeled and faced him expectantly.
Have you got your stables here? Asked Gatsby with an effort.
About a quarter of a mile down the road.
Oh.
A pause.
I don't see the idea of going to town, broke out Tom savagely. Women get these notions in their heads. Shall we take anything to drink? Called Daisy from an upper window.
I'll get some whiskey, answered Tom. He went inside. Gatsby turned to me rigidly. I can't say anything in his house, old sport. She's got an indiscreet voice, I remarked. It's full of... I hesitated. Her voice is full of money, he said suddenly. That was it. I'd never understood before. It was full of money. That was the inexhaustible charm that rose and fell in it. The jingle of it. The cymbal song of it. High in a white palace, the king's daughter... The Golden Girl. Tom came out of the house wrapping a quart bottle in a towel, followed by Daisy and Jordan wearing small tight hats of metallic cloth and carrying light capes over their arms.
Shall we all go in my car? Suggested Gatsby. He felt the hot green leather of the seat.
I ought to have left it in the shade.
Is it standard shift? Demanded Tom.
Yes.
Well, you take my coupe and let me drive your car to town.
The suggestion was distasteful to Gatsby.
I don't think there's much gas, he objected.
Plenty of gas, said Tom boisterously. He looked at the gauge. And if it runs out, I can stop at a drugstore. You can buy anything at a drugstore nowadays.
A pause followed this apparently pointless remark. Daisy looked at Tom, frowning, and an indefinable expression at once definitely unfamiliar and vaguely recognizable, as if I'd only heard it described in words, passed over Gatsby's face.
Come on, Daisy, said Tom, pressing her with his hand toward Gatsby's car. I'll take you in this circus wagon.
He opened the door, but she moved out from the circle of his arm. You take Nick and Jordan. We'll follow you in the coupe. She walked close to Gatsby, touching his coat with her hand. Jordan and Tom and I got into the front seat of Gatsby's car. Tom pushed the unfamiliar gears tentatively, and we shot off into the oppressive heat, leaving them out of sight behind.
Did you see that? Demanded Tom.
See what?
He looked at me keenly, realizing that Jordan and I must have known all along.
You think I'm pretty dumb, don't you? He suggested. Perhaps I am, but I have a almost a second sight sometimes that tells me what to do. Maybe you don't believe that, but science... He paused. The immediate contingency overtook him, pulled him back from the edge of the theoretical abyss. I've made a small investigation of this fellow, he continued. I could have gone deeper if I'd known...
Do you mean you've been to a medium? Inquired Jordan humorously.
What? Confused, he stared at us as we laughed. A medium?
About Gatsby.
About Gatsby? No, I haven't. I said I'd been making a small investigation of his past.
And you found he was an Oxford man, said Jordan helpfully.
An Oxford man? He was incredulous. Like hell he is. He wears a pink suit.
Nevertheless, he's an Oxford man.
Oxford, New Mexico, snorted Tom contemptuously, or something like that.
Listen, Tom, if you're such a snob, why did you invite him to lunch? Demanded Jordan crossly.
Daisy invited him. She knew him before we were married. God knows where.
We were all irritable now with the fading ale, and aware of it, we drove for a while in silence.
Then, as Dr. T.J. Eckelberg's faded eyes came into sight down the road, I remembered Gatsby's caution about gasoline.
We've got enough to get us to town, said Tom.
But there's a garage right here, objected Jordan. I don't want to get stalled in this baking heat.
Tom threw on both brakes impatiently, and we slid to an abrupt, dusty spot under Wilson's sign. After a moment, the proprietor emerged from the interior of his establishment and gazed hollow-eyed at the car.
Let's have some gas, cried Tom roughly.
What do you think we stopped for, to admire the view?
I'm sick, said Wilson without moving. Been sick all day.
What's the matter?
I'm all run down.
Well, shall I help myself? Tom demanded.
You sounded well enough on the phone.
With an effort, Wilson left the shade and support of the doorway and, breathing hard, unscrewed the cap of the tank. In the sunlight, his face was green.
I didn't mean to interrupt your lunch, he said, but I need money pretty bad, and I was wondering what you were going to do with your old car.
How do you like this one? Inquired Tom. I bought it last week.
It's a nice yellow one, said Wilson, as he strained at the handle.
Like to buy it?
Big chance, Wilson smiled faintly.
No, but I could make some money on the other.
What do you want money for all of a sudden?
I've been here too long. I want to get away. My wife and I want to go west.
Your wife does? Exclaimed Tom, startled.
She's been talking about it for 10 years.
He rested for a moment against the pump, shading his eyes. And now she's going whether she wants to or not. I'm going to get her away.
The coupe flashed by us with a flurry of dust and the flash of a waving hand.
What do I owe you? Demanded Tom harshly.
I just got wised up to something funny the last 2 days, remarked Wilson. That's why I want to get away. That's why I've been bothering you about the car.
What do I owe you?
$1.20.
The relentless beating heat was beginning to confuse me, and I had a bad moment there before I realized that so far his suspicions hadn't alighted on Tom. He had discovered that Myrtle had some sort of life apart from him in another world, and the shock had made him physically sick. I stared at him and then at Tom, who had made a parallel discovery less than an hour before, and it occurred to me that there was no difference between men in intelligence or race so profound as the difference between the sick and the well. Wilson was so sick that he looked guilty, unforgivably guilty, as if he had just got some poor girl with child.
I'll let you have that car, said Tom. I'll send it over tomorrow afternoon.
That locality was always vaguely disquieting, even in the broad glare of afternoon, and now I turned my head as though I'd been warned of something behind. Over the ash heaps, the giant eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg kept their vigil, but I perceived after a moment that the other eyes were regarding us less than 20 feet away. In one of the windows over the garage, the curtains had been moved aside a little, and Myrtle Wilson was peering down at the car. So engrossed was she that she had no consciousness of being observed, and one emotion after another crept into her face like objects into a slowly developing picture. Her expression was curiously familiar. It was an expression I'd often seen on women's faces, but on Myrtle Wilson's face it seemed purposeless and inexplicable until I realized that her eyes, wide with jealous terror, were fixed not on Tom, but on me. but on Jordan Baker, whom she took to be his wife. There is no confusion like the confusion of a simple mind, and as we drove away, Tom was feeling the hot whips of panic. His wife and his mistress, until an hour ago secure and inviolate, were slipping precipitately from his control. Instinct made him step on the accelerator with the double purpose of overtaking Daisy and leaving Wilson behind. And we sped along toward Astoria at 50 miles an hour until among the spidery girders of the elevated we came in sight of the easy-going blue coupe. "Those big movies around 50th Street are cool," suggested Jordan. "I love New York on summer afternoons when everyone's away. There's something very sensuous about it. Overripe, as if all sorts of funny fruits were going to fall into your hands." The word sensuous had the effect of further disquieting Tom, but before he could invent a protest, the coupe came to a stop, and Daisy signaled us to draw up alongside. "Where are we going?" she cried. "How about the movies?" "It's so hot," she complained. "You go. We'll ride around and meet you after." With an effort, her wit rose faintly. "We'll meet you on some corner. I'll be the man smoking 2 cigarettes. "Look, we can't argue about it here," Tom said impatiently, as a truck gave out a cursing whistle behind us. "You follow me to the south side of Central Park in front of the plaza." Several times he turned his head and looked back for their car, and if the traffic delayed them, he slowed up until they came into sight. I think he was afraid they would dart down a side street and out of his life forever. But they didn't. And we all took the less explicable step of engaging the parlor of a suite in the Plaza Hotel. The prolonged and tumultuous argument that ended by herding us into that room eludes me, though I have a sharp physical memory that in the course of it, my underwear kept climbing like a damp snake around my legs and intermittent beads of sweat raced cool across my back. The notion originated with Daisy's suggestion that we hire 5 bathrooms and take cold baths, and then assumed more tangible form as a place to have a mint julep. Each of us said over and over that it was a crazy idea. We all talked at once to a baffled clerk and thought or pretended to think that we were being very funny. The room was large and stifling, and though it was already 4 o'clock, opening the windows admitted only a gust of hot shrubbery from the park. Daisy went to the mirror and stood with her back to us fixing her hair. "It's a swell suite," whispered Jordan respectfully, and everyone laughed. "Open another window," commanded Daisy without turning around. "There aren't any more." "Well, we'd better telephone for an axe." "The thing to do is to forget about the heat," said Tom impatiently. "You make it 10 times worse by crabbing about it." He unrolled the bottle of whiskey from the towel and put it on the table. "Why not let her alone, old sport?" remarked Gatsby. "You're the one that wanted to come to town." There was a moment of silence. The telephone book slipped from its nail and splashed to the floor, whereupon Jordan whispered, "Excuse me." But this time no one laughed. "I'll pick it up," I offered. "I've got it." Gatsby examined the parted string, muttered, "Hmm," in an interested way, and tossed the book on a chair. "That's a great expression of yours, isn't it?" said Tom sharply. "What is?" "All this old sport business. Where'd you pick that up?" "Now, see here, Tom," said Daisy, turning around from the mirror. "If you're going to make personal remarks, I won't stay here a minute. Call up and order some ice for the mint julep." As Tom took up the receiver, the compressed heat exploded into sound, and we were listening to the portentous chords of Mendelssohn's Wedding March from the ballroom below. "Oh, imagine marrying anybody in this heat," cried Jordan dismally. "Still, I was married in the middle of June," Daisy remembered. "Louisville in June. Somebody fainted. Who was it fainted, Tom?"
"Biloxi," he answered shortly.
"A man named Biloxi. Blocks Biloxi, and he made boxes. That's a fact, and he was from Biloxi, Mississippi." "They carried him into my house," appended Jordan, "because we lived just 2 doors from the church, and he stayed 3 weeks until Daddy told him he had to get out. The day after he left, Daddy died." After a moment, she added, as if she might have sounded irreverent, "There wasn't any connection."
"I used to know a Bill Biloxi from Memphis," I remarked.
"That was his cousin. I knew his whole family history before he left. He gave me an aluminum putter that I use today." The music had died down as the ceremony began, and now a long cheer floated in at the window followed by intermittent cries of yay, and finally by a burst of jazz as the dancing began.
We're getting old, said Daisy. If we were young, we'd rise and dance.
Remember Biloxi, Jordan warned her. Where'd you know him, Tom?
Biloxi? He concentrated with an effort. I didn't know him. He was a friend of Daisy's.
He was not, she denied. I'd never seen him before. He came down in the private car.
Well, he said he knew you. He said he was raised in Louisville. Asa Bird brought him around at the last minute and asked if we had room for him.
Jordan smiled. He was probably bumming his way home. He told me he was president of your class at Yale.
Tom and I looked at each other blankly.
Biloxi?
First place, we didn't have any president.
Gatsby's foot beat a short, restless tattoo, and Tom eyed him suddenly.
By the way, Mr. Gatsby, I understand you're an Oxford man.
Not exactly.
Oh, yes, I understand you went to Oxford.
Yes, I went there.
A pause. Then Tom's voice, incredulous and insulting.
You must have gone there about the time Biloxi went to New Haven.
Another pause. A waiter knocked and came in with crushed mint and ice, but the silence was unbroken by his thank you and the soft closing of the door. This tremendous detail was to be cleared up at last.
I told you I went there, said Gatsby.
I heard you, but I'd like to know when.
It was in 1919. I only stayed 5 months. That's why I can't really call myself an Oxford man.
Tom glanced around to see if we mirrored his unbelief, but we were all looking at Gatsby.
It was an opportunity they gave to some of the officers after the armistice, he continued. We could go to any of the universities in England or France.
I wanted to get up and slap him on the back. I had one of those renewals of complete faith in him that I'd experienced before.
Daisy rose, smiling faintly, and went to the table.
Open the whiskey, Tom, she ordered, and I'll make you a mint julep. Then you won't seem so stupid to yourself.
Look at the mint.
Wait a minute, snapped Tom. I want to ask Mr. Gatsby one more question.
Go on, Gatsby said politely.
What kind of a row are you trying to cause in my house anyhow?
They were out in the open at last, and Gatsby was content.
He isn't causing a row. Daisy looked desperately from one to the other. You're causing a row. Please have a little self-control.
Self-control? Repeated Tom incredulously.
I suppose the latest thing is to sit back and let Mr. Nobody from Nowhere make love to your wife.
Well, if that's the idea, you can count me out. Nowadays, people begin by sneering at family life and family institutions, and next they'll throw everything overboard and have intermarriage between black and white.
Flushed with his impassioned gibberish, he saw himself standing alone on the last barrier of civilization.
We're all white here, murmured Jordan.
I know I'm not very popular. I don't give big parties. I suppose you've got to make your house into a pigsty in order to have any friends in the modern world.
Angry as I was, as we all were, I was tempted to laugh whenever he opened his mouth. The transition from libertine to prig was so complete.
I've got something to tell you, old sport, began Gatsby, but Daisy guessed at his intention.
Please don't, she interrupted helplessly. Please, please, let's all go home. Why don't we all go home?
That's a good idea. I got up. Come on, Tom. Nobody wants a drink.
I want to know what Mr. Gatsby has to tell me.
Your wife doesn't love you, said Gatsby. She's never loved you. She loves me.
You must be crazy, exclaimed Tom automatically.
Gatsby sprang to his feet, vivid with excitement.
She never loved you, do you hear? He cried. She only married you because I was poor and she was tired of waiting for me. It was a terrible mistake, but in her heart she never loved anyone except me.
At this point, Jordan and I tried to go, but Tom and Gatsby insisted with competitive firmness that we remain, as though neither of them had anything to conceal, and it would be a privilege to partake vicariously of their emotions.
Sit down, Daisy.
Tom's voice groped unsuccessfully for the paternal note.
What's been going on?
I want to hear all about it.
I told you what's been going on, said Gatsby. Going on for 5 years, and you didn't know.
Tom turned to Daisy sharply.
You've been seeing this fellow for 5 years?
Not seeing, said Gatsby. No, we couldn't meet. But both of us loved each other all that time, old sport, and you didn't know.
Oh, that's all.
Tom tapped his thick fingers together like a clergyman and leaned back in his chair.
You're crazy, he exploded. I can't speak about what happened 5 years ago because I didn't know Daisy then, and I'll be damned if I see how you got within a mile of her, unless you brought the groceries to the back door. But all the rest of that's a goddamn lie. Daisy loved me when she married me, and she loves me now. No, said Gatsby, shaking his head. She does, though. The trouble is that sometimes she gets foolish ideas in her head and doesn't know what she's doing. He nodded sagely. And what's more, I love Daisy, too. But once in a while I go off on a spree and make a fool of myself, but I always come back. And in my heart I love her all the time. You're revolting, said Daisy. She turned to me, and her voice, dropping an octave lower, filled the room with thrilling scorn. Do you know why we left Chicago? I'm surprised that they didn't treat you to the story of that little spree. Gatsby walked over and stood beside her. Daisy, that's all over now, he said earnestly. It doesn't matter anymore. Just tell him the truth, that you never loved him, and it's all wiped out forever. She looked at him blindly. Why, how could I love him, possibly? You never loved him. She hesitated. Her eyes fell on Jordan and me with a sort of appeal, as though she realized at last what she was doing, and as though she had never all along intended doing anything at all. But it was done now. It was too late. I never loved him, she said, with perceptible reluctance. Not at Kapiolani? Demanded Tom suddenly. No. From the ballroom beneath, muffled and suffocating chords were drifting up on hot waves of air. Not that day I carried you down from the punch bowl to keep your shoes dry? There was a husky tenderness in his voice. Daisy? Please don't. Her voice was cold, but the rancor was gone from it. She looked at Gatsby. There, Jay, she said. But her hand, as she tried to light a cigarette, was trembling. Suddenly she threw the cigarette and the burning match on the carpet. Oh, you want too much, she cried to Gatsby. I love you now. Isn't that enough? I can't help what's past. She began to sob helplessly. I did love him once, but I loved you, too. Gatsby's eyes opened and closed. You loved me, too? He repeated. Even that's a lie, said Tom savagely. She didn't know you were alive. Why, there are things between Daisy and me that you'll never know, things that neither of us can ever forget. The words seemed to bite physically into Gatsby. I want to speak to Daisy alone, he insisted. She's all excited now. Even alone, I can't say I never loved Tom, she admitted in a pitiful voice. It wouldn't be true. Of course it wouldn't, agreed Tom. She turned to her husband. As if it mattered to you, she said. Of course it matters. I'm going to take better care of you from now on. You don't understand, said Gatsby with a touch of panic. You're not going to take care of her any more. I'm not. Tom opened his eyes wide and laughed. He could afford to control himself now. Why's that? Daisy's leaving you. Nonsense. I am, though, she said, with a visible effort. She's not leaving me. Tom's words suddenly leaned down over Gatsby. Certainly not for a common swindler who'd have to steal the ring he put on her finger. I won't stand this, cried Daisy. Oh, please, let's get out. Who are you, anyhow? Broke out Tom. You're one of that bunch that hangs around with Meyer Wolfsheim. That much I happen to know. I made a little investigation into your affairs, and I'll carry it further tomorrow. You can suit yourself about that, old sport, said Gatsby steadily. I found out what your drug stores were. He turned to us and spoke rapidly. He and this Wolfheim bought up a lot of side street drug stores here and in Chicago and sold grain alcohol over the counter. That's one of his little stunts. I picked him for a bootlegger the first time I saw him, and I wasn't far wrong. What about it? Said Gatsby politely. I guess your friend Walter Chase wasn't too proud to come in on it. And you left him in the lurch, didn't you? You let him go to jail for a month over New Jersey. God, you ought to hear Walter on the subject of you. He came to us dead broke. He was very glad to pick up some money, old sport. Don't you call me old sport, cried Tom. Gatsby said nothing. Walter could have you up on the betting laws, too, but Wolfsheim scared him into shutting his mouth. That unfamiliar yet recognizable look was back again in Gatsby's face. That drugstore business was just small change, continued Tom slowly. But you've got something on now that Walter's afraid to tell me about. I glanced at Daisy, who was staring terrified between Gatsby and her husband, and at Jordan, who had begun to balance an invisible but absorbing object on the tip of her chin. Then I turned back to Gatsby and was startled at his expression. He looked, and this is said in all contempt for the babbled slander of his garden, as if he had killed a man. For a moment, the set of his face could be described in just that fantastic way. It passed, and he began to talk excitedly to Daisy, denying everything, defending his name against accusations that had not been made. But with every word, she was drawing further and further into herself. So he gave that up, and only the dead dream fought on as the afternoon slipped away, trying to touch what was no longer tangible, struggling unhappily, undespairingly, toward that lost voice across the room. The voice begged again to go.
"Please, Tom, I can't stand this anymore."
Her frightened eyes told that whatever intentions, whatever courage she had, were definitely gone. "You two start on home, Daisy," said Tom, "in Mr. Gatsby's car." She looked at Tom, alarmed now, but he insisted with magnanimous scorn, "Go on. He won't annoy you. I think he realizes that his presumptuous little flirtation is over." They were gone without a word, snapped out, made accidental, isolated like ghosts even from our pity. After a moment, Tom got up and began wrapping the unopened bottle of whiskey in the towel. "Want any of this stuff? Jordan? Nick?" I didn't answer. "Nick?" he asked again. "What? Want any?" "No. I just remembered that today's my birthday. I was 30. Before me stretched the portentous, menacing road of a new decade." It was 7 o'clock when we got into the coupe with him and started for Long Island. Tom talked incessantly, exulting and laughing, but his voice was as remote from Jordan and me as the foreign clamor on the sidewalk or the tumult of the elevated overhead. Human sympathy has its limits, and we were content to let all their tragic arguments fade with the city lights behind. 30. The promise of a decade of loneliness. A thinning list of single men to know, a thinning briefcase of enthusiasm, thinning hair. But there was Jordan beside me, who, unlike Daisy, was too wise ever to carry well-forgotten dreams from age to age. As we passed over the dark bridge, her wan face fell lazily against my coat's shoulder, and the formidable stroke of 30 died away with the reassuring pressure of her hand. So we drove on toward death through the cooling twilight. The young Greek, Michaelis, who ran the coffee joint beside the ash heaps, was the principal witness at the inquest. He had slept through the heat until after 5, when he strolled over to the garage and found George Wilson sick in his office, really sick, pale as his own pale hair and shaking all over. Michaelis advised him to go to bed, but Wilson refused, saying that he'd miss a lot of business if he did. While his neighbor was trying to persuade him, a violent racket broke out overhead. "I've got my wife locked in up there," explained Wilson calmly. "She's going to stay there till the day after tomorrow, and then we're going to move away." Michaelis was astonished. They'd been neighbors for 4 years, and Wilson had never seemed faintly capable of such a statement. Generally, he was one of those worn-out men. When he wasn't working, he sat on a chair in the doorway and stared at the people in the cars that passed along the road. When anyone spoke to him, he invariably laughed in an agreeable, colorless way. He was his wife's man and not his own. So naturally, Michaelis tried to find out what had happened, but Wilson wouldn't say a word. Instead, he began to throw curious, suspicious glances at his visitor and ask him what he'd been doing at certain times on certain days. Just as the latter was getting uneasy, some workmen came past the door bound for his restaurant, and Michaelis took the opportunity to get away, intending to come back later. But he didn't. He supposed he forgot to, that's all. When he came outside again a little after 7, he was reminded of the conversation because he heard Mrs. Wilson's voice, loud and scolding, downstairs in the garage. "Beat me," he heard her cry. "Throw me down and beat me, you dirty little coward." A moment later, she rushed out into the dusk, waving her hands and shouting. Before he could move from his door, the business was over. The death car, as the newspapers called it, didn't stop. It came out of the gathering darkness, wavered tragically for a moment, and then disappeared around the next bend. Michaelis wasn't even sure of its color. He told the first policeman that it was light green. The other car, the one going toward New York, came to rest 100 yards beyond, and its driver hurried back to where Myrtle Wilson, her life violently extinguished, knelt in the road and mingled her thick, dark blood with the dust. Michaelis and this man reached her first, but when they'd torn open her shirtwaist, still damp with perspiration, they saw that her left breast was swinging loose like a flap, and there was no need to listen for the heart beneath. The mouth was wide open and ripped at the corners, as though she had choked a little in giving up the tremendous vitality she had stored so long.